you could have all kinds of encryption, but if the person you're communicating with doesn't have any way to decipher it or vice versa, then you're in trouble. So, I mean, if you can have telecommunications companies do point-to-point encryption where NSA doesn't have any access to the algorithms and all that that make up the encryption, and that's an easy way, and I'd like to see companies move in that direction, but I just don't see that happening in the near future. So the most effective way immediately is to have the courts decide that this is illegal, what the government is doing, and to have them stop it.
Thank you. Question over here.
Yes, could you tell me which of the major telecommunications companies are cooperating with NSA and which are not?
Well, as far as I know, I mean, that's one of the questions that is that a number of these suits are trying to answer. As far as I know, all the major telecommunications companies are, with one exception. QWest decided to not go along with the request. And it would be interesting to see whether there's been any retaliation or whatever. But right now, it looks like they don't have to have total cooperation. What they need is cooperation from the companies that are in charge of the cables that come in and go out of the United States. You know, once you have that, then you've pretty much got everything. And that's largely AT&T, Verizon, and a few others.
Thank you. Over here.
I'm a fairly anxious person in general. And because of the Patriot Act and other things that the government is doing, even though I'm fairly low income, I had decided finally to join the ACLU. And my question is, the government, I feel sometimes incapable even of stopping our state from funding sports stadiums, much less changing things like the Patriot Act. And I appreciate that the ACLU is doing this, but it takes years and years for something to happen to stop something that started maybe 5 years ago, and the legislature keeps doing things every single year after that. And I wondered if you could address that anxiety.
Well, I will offer that one of the things you can do right now, I've been handed your Real ID fact sheet, but it's SB 5087. And one of the things that we've found is that having citizens go to their lawmakers and say, listen, I don't want a national ID card. You're a state, and you don't either, frankly, state lawmaker. You don't want to pay for it. You don't want to be the one that gets blamed when I can't get my driver's license for a variety of reasons next year. So why don't you get behind this law in Washington State that says that Real ID isn't going to go into effect without real privacy protections and real guarantees that the federal government will pay for it. I really think that's a concrete step you can take right now. As to longer-term things like the Patriot Act, things like the telecommunications stuff we're talking about now, there are no quick fixes. Or at least very few. The United States is a very big ship, and it turns very slowly on its, we're talking about major policies like surveillance and the war on terror. But I've also found that when it does turn, it tends to get pointed in a better direction. And those reforms, I mean, FISA was in effect, and I think abided by, relatively speaking, for 20 years. So it's not, it takes a long time to fight these fights, but they're worth fighting. And when they're won, we can all take a deep breath, at least for a little while.
Well, just a comment on that. I agree. And the you can see, like Chris says, the government moves slowly, but it didn't move at all for the last number of years, and now it's moving a bit. I've been up to Congress a number of times since January and talked to a number of committees, and they are looking into holding hearings on a number of things. And you can see how the system is working in a positive way, in a sense. They did create, after the abuses before, they did create the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And though I'm not a big fan of the FISA Court because it hasn't been as strong as I would have liked, the fact was they did create it, and up until 2001, NSA had abided by it. And then when NSA didn't abide by it, they were sued by the ACLU, and you had a federal judge in August declare the NSA's operations illegal. And then you had 2 weeks before our appeals court hearing, the NSA, the Justice Department coming out, Attorney General coming out and saying, we're going to go back to going through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Now, whether they really are and so forth, that's up to question. But, you know, you can see that this push is working to some degree. Whether it'll finally succeed, I'm an optimist, so I see these as positive moves. So you've got to sort of look at the glass as sort of half filled as opposed to half empty some of the time.
I'll just add, this brings us back to letting the ACLU know that you want to be alerted, whether through email or some other fashion, so that you can know which legislator to target when the bill is coming up. That's a great way to participate this in a more concerted effort. We are over here. Yes.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Bamford. Do you think that the NSA possesses the capability to decipher conventional encryption that's used on the internet, such as SSL?
Oh, sure. They can. They're very good at breaking almost any kind of commercial encryption. I mean, that's what they specialize in for years and years, and they have massive supercomputers that do enormous number crunching and brute force and so forth. The problem is they can focus on one sort of series of messages or whatever, but when you use encryption, it's extremely time-consuming for NSA. So they've got to pick and choose. They can't decrypt everything instantaneously. It takes time and effort. So encryption is a solution. It's not a. If they really want to break your encryption, they can do it. But it does provide a level of protection. So I'm a big fan of encryption, and I think that really is the ultimate solution to some of the problems. If we can get it widespread and we can get it easily operative between the various parties involved in a communications, it would be one solution. But we're a ways away from that now.
Thank you. Over here.
I wonder if the NSA might have been involved in this situation. I'm a supporter of Attorney Lynn Stewart, who the government wanted to put away for 30 years for violating the Patriot Act. And she's now fighting the last 28 months of that. And will be in town on March 10th at Seattle University. I wonder if the NSA was involved in intercepting communications that she and her co-defendants had that gave the government the information on her that they wanted.
Well, I'm not an expert on her case, but I'm pretty sure I remember them using the FISA warrant to eavesdrop on their communications. There's two agencies that basically use FISA. One of them is the FBI. If they want to place a particular bug on a particular telephone, that's usually the FBI. It does wholesale, or rather it does what basically is known as retail eavesdropping, individual eavesdropping, eavesdropping on particular people's telephones and so forth. The NSA does wholesale eavesdropping, where they eavesdrop on enormous circuits coming in and then filter those circuits through computers. So if they did it in her case, it would have been at least the NSA's involvement would have been putting her name into NSA's computer so that when that stream of telecommunications passed through, anything to or from her, or anything to or from her email address or to or from her telephone number or whatever, would have been kicked out and analyzed by NSA.
We are just about out of time. I think we have time for one more question, and I'm sorry.
Just a quick question. It's silly, but you see these huge disks, and I wonder, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is that messaging that goes back and forth?
Now, there's different types of dishes. If you walk around Seattle and you look on the top of buildings, you'll see small dishes. Those are transmitting microwaves. That's the same thing as if it's a telephone line. It contains thousands of calls. If you're seeing a large dish, a 90-meter dish or whatever, 90-foot dish, they're usually communicating to a satellite. But again, all those are your communications. Everybody here is communications. That's how communications are transmitted these days. They're transmitted largely by signal and by these dishes. So that's the whole idea. If the communication is being transmitted by a signal through the air, either by a microwave dish or by a satellite dish, it's very easy for the NSA to put another dish out there and collect it without ever touching a wire. And that's why NSA's eavesdropping is very dangerous. As I mentioned, the FBI will tap a wire to a house and listen to a phone call. NSA will eavesdrop on entire streams, which may in microwaves contain thousands, or in satellite communications, millions of phone calls.
Let's thank James Bamford and Chris Calabrese.
You've been listening to James Bamford and Chris Calabrese speaking on Confronting the Surveillance Society at the Washington State Annual ACLU Convention in February. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. RFID surveillance is now on our doorstep here in Central New York. We have learned that the sheriff's departments in every county in New York State have received a grant from the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services to outfit patrol cars with RFID readers in order to scan RFID tags that the state plans to embed in the auto registration tags that each car must display. The nation of Bermuda is in the process of implementing such a program already, ostensibly to enforce vehicle registration and insurance compliance. RFID readers will be placed on streets throughout the island, and cars not displaying the proper tag will be photographed and ticketed. But the result goes way beyond vehicle registration. The movement of every car on the island can be potentially cataloged, and drivers of interest to the government can be easily tracked. How about every car parked near an anti-war rally? It now becomes cheap and easy to scoop up all their identities and file them, or add them to a no-fly or similar list. When linked to an RFID-embedded identity card, the government can keep records of who is in every car, perhaps in every house. Of course, they're not interested in every person in every house, just people like me, or perhaps you. Once your car has been identified at a peace march, your identity can be determined, and your phones and email tapped, your contacts logged, your plans to oppose the government or the corporations noted. Almost everybody has broken some law at some time. People who they wish to target can have their lives made a living hell with law enforcement. People the government doesn't like can be heavily surveilled, then cited and prosecuted for every infraction. The average person could be destroyed even by the imposition of a series of relatively small fines. Then, as a result of your criminal record, after they beggar you with all the fines and you can't pay your bills, your credit card company will jack up your interest rate, and your insurance company will jack up your premium because you're a high risk, given that your name appears on a terrorist watch list. You can see how you could quickly spiral into destitution, a strong incentive to shut up and obey. The time to fight these things is before they're put into place, before you have to risk arrest in order to resist. If this is going on in New York State, it must be happening elsewhere. We'll keep following this story. If you have any info, please email the show through the website at unwelcomeguests.org.
Robinson was a farmer. He grew the Minnesota wheat. He rode there with his daughter, high upon the thresher's seat. They broke down on the hillside, the radiator spitting steam. Went back to get the toolbox so they could fix the old machine. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we can fix the tractor, we can make it like new. But that day they got a letter that said the power lines would come right across their farmland, right across the setting sun. So they gathered all the family and talked late into the night. We cannot let them do this. We've got to put up one hell of a fight. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we'll apply a little pressure and we'll see what that will do. So they phoned 100 farmers and drove to the Twin Cities. Met there with the governor and they sued the utility. But after writing all the letters and paying all the legal costs to the power of the city, once again the farmers lost. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the wheat fields alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. So they met there at the tavern, but there wasn't much to say. The power lines may come, but they will not stay. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once put together, we can easily undo. With bandanas on their faces, careful not to make a sound, they loosened all the bolts that held the towers to the ground. And several weeks later, with nobody around, Minnesota wind blew tower after tower after tower down. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once put together, we can easily undo. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once together, we can easily undo. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the wheat fields alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. Our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our
That was Turn of the Wrench by Dana Lyons, based on a true story. Interfering with power lines was made a federal offense. The system of private property and corporate rights in American law has been used to enable corporations to go into a community and destroy its peace, beauty, and character for their financial benefit. This was addressed on last week's show by Richard Grossman of CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Tom Lindsay, founder and chief counsel of CELDEF, will be speaking locally, that is, local for Finger Lakes listeners, on July 16th, that is, a week from tomorrow. Through Lindsay and his staff's efforts in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, over 70 townships have passed local laws directly asserting the authority of the majority of citizens in those towns to determine what their towns will look like and accept. Issues stimulating those laws included the dumping of unwanted sewage sludge, the creation of, quote, development projects driven by a few, privatization of water supplies, pollution of water supplies, and many others. Lindsay founded the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund in an effort to address these growing community concerns. Out of this, democracy schools and a new organizing model eventually evolved. Should New York's townships duplicate these efforts? Several local threats are emerging of concern to our area, including the spreading of sewage sludge on Tompkins and Schuyler County farmland, and the expansion of a quarry at the old Padua site in Watkins Glen, which has already been permitted without public input by the so-called Department of Environmental Conservation of New York State. You can come hear Tom Lindsay of CELDEF July 16th at the Rural Urban Center on Broadway in Montour Falls. The talk starts at 7. A donation of $10 is being asked to cover expenses, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. Organized action is the only effective means to preserve a world worth living in. That's July 16th at the Rural Urban Center in Montour Falls. For more information, you can email sandhill1@frontiernet.net. Sandhill1, that's the number 1, at frontiernet.net.
First you told Sony, through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, then he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood, fought so many pointless wars. And now you build your fences and you say there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you say these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you'd own the water all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genome of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name, and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio. Have our songs pass your test. You own country, you own western. You say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you hold on the music all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would own everything all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
We'll conclude the program with our next installment of our reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. This starting with Chapter 17, The Politics of Schooling. Gatto begins the chapter with several quotes. Each year, the child is coming to belong more to the state and less to the parent. Elwood P. Cubberley, Conceptions of Education, 1909. It was natural businessmen should devote themselves to something besides business, that they should seek to influence the enactment and administration of laws, national and international, and that they should try to control education. Max Otto, Science and the Moral Life, 1949. Most people don't know who controls American education because little attention has been given the question by either educators or the public. Also, because the question is not easily or neatly answered. James D. Kerner, Who Controls American Education, 1968. Gatto continues. In October 1990, three round holes the size of silver dollars appeared in the floor of my classroom at Booker T. Washington Junior High between West 107th and 108th Streets in Spanish Harlem, about 12 blocks from Columbia Teachers College. My room was on the third floor, and the holes went through to the second floor room underneath. In unguarded moments, those holes proved an irresistible lure to my students, who dropped spitballs, food, and ball bearings down on the heads of helpless children below without warning. The screams of outrage were appalling. So pragmatically, without thinking much about it, I closed off the holes with a large flat of plywood and dutifully sent a note to the school custodian asking for professional assistance. The next day when I reported to work, my makeshift closure was gone. The holes were open, and I found a warning against, quote, unauthorized repairs in my mailbox. That day, three different teachers used the room with the holes. During each occupancy, various objects plummeted through the floor to the consternation of the occupants in the space below. In one particularly offensive assault, human waste was retrieved from the toilet, fashioned into a missile, and dropped on a shrieking victim. All the while, the attacking classroom exploded in cackles of laughter, I was later told. On the third day of these aerial assaults, the building principal appeared at my door, demanding the bombardment cease at once. I pointed out that I had been forbidden to close off the holes, that many other teachers used the room in my absence, that the school provided no sanctions for student aggressors, and that it was impossible to teach a class of 35 kids and still keep close watch on three well-dispersed holes in the floor. I offered to repair the holes again at my own expense, pointing out in a reasonable tone that this easy solution was still available, and that, in my opinion, there were traces of insanity in allowing any protocol, however well meant, to delay solving the problem at once before another fecal bombardment was unleashed. At that moment, I had no idea that I was challenging an invisible legion of salarymen it had taken a century to evolve. I only wanted to spare myself those cries from below. My request was denied, and I was reminded again not to take matters into my own hands. 5 months later, a repair was effected by a team of technicians. In the meantime, however, my classroom door lock had been broken and three panes of window glass facing Columbus Avenue shattered by vandals. The repair crew turned a deaf ear to what I felt was a pretty sensible request to do all the work at once, none of it complicated. The technicians were on a particular mission, I was told. Only it had been duly authorized. Commenting on the whole genus of such school turf wars, the New York Observer's Terry Galway said, quote, "Critical decisions are made in a bureaucrat's office far from the site requiring repairs. One official's decision can be countermanded by another's, and layer upon layer of officialdom prolongs the process. A physical task that requires a couple of minutes' work can take weeks, if not months, to snake through the bureaucracy. In the meantime, the condition may worsen, causing inconvenience to children and teachers. In the end, no one is accountable." Close quote. Thanks to Mr. Galway, I found out why the missile attack had been allowed to continue. In my case, the problem lay in the journey of my original note to the custodian, where it was translated into form PO18. PO18 set out on a road which would terminate in an eventual repair, but not before eight other stops were made along the way and 150 days had passed. A study of these eight stops will provide a scalpel to expose some of the gangrenous tissue of institutional schooling. Although this is New York City, something similar is found everywhere else the government school flag waves. So I think we must finally grow up enough to realize that what follows is unavoidable, endemic to large systems. Stop 1. PO 18 was signed by the principal, who gave a copy to his secretary to file, returning the original to the custodian. This typically takes several days. Stop 2. The custodian gave a copy of the form to his secretary to file, then sent the request to a district plant manager, DPM, one of 31 in New York City. Stop 3. In an office far removed from my perforated floor, the DPM assigned the repair a priority code. 3 or 4 weeks had now passed from the minute a ball bearing bounced off of Paul Colon's head and a turd splattered in gooey fragments on Rosie Santiago's desk. A copy of PO 18 was given to the DPM secretary to file, and the form went to the resource planning manager, RPM, based in Long Island City. Stop 4. The RPM collects all the work orders in the city, sorting them according to priority codes and available resources, and selects a resource planning team, RPT. This team then enters the PO18 in its own computer. A repair sequence is arrested at stop 4 for a period of weeks. Stop 5. The PO18 is relayed to the Integrated Purchasing and Inventory System, IPIS, which spits out a work order and sends it to the supervising supervisor. 3 months have passed, and used toilet paper is raining down into the airless cell beneath John Gatto's English class. Stop 6. The supervising supervisor has one responsibility: to supervise the trade supervisors and decide which one will at some time not fix, but supervise the fixing of my floor. Such a decision requires due time before an order is issued. Stop 7. The trade supervisor has responsibility for selecting service people of flesh and blood to actually do the work. Eventually, the trade supervisor does this, dispatching a work crew to perform the repair. Time elapsed, in this case, 5 months. Some repairs take 10 years. Some, forever. I was lucky. Stop 8. Armed with bags and utility belts, tradespeople enter the school to examine the problem. If it can be repaired with the tools they carry, fine. If not, they must fill out a PO17 to to requisition the needed materials, and a new and different sequence begins. It's all very logical. Each step is justified. If you think this can be reformed, you are indeed ignorant. Fire all these people, and unless you are willing to kill them, they will just have to be employed in some other fashion equally useless. At the heart of the durability of mass schooling is a brilliantly designed power fragmentation system, which distributes decision-making so widely among so many different warring interests that large-scale change is impossible to those without a codebook. Even when a favorable chance alteration occurs, it has a short lifespan, usually exactly as long as the originator of the happy change has political protection. When the first boom of enthusiasm wanes or protection erodes, the innovation follows soon after. No visible level of the system, top, middle, or bottom, is allowed to institute any significant change without permission from many other layers. To secure this coalition of forces puts the supplicant in such a compromised position and takes so long that any possibility of very extensive alteration is foreclosed. Structurally, control is divided among three categories of interdependent power: government agencies, the self-proclaimed knowledge industry, and various special interests, some permanent, some topical. Nominally, children, teachers, and parents are included in this third group, but since all are kept virtually powerless, with rare exceptions, they are looked upon only as nuisances to be gotten around. Parents are considered the enemy everywhere in the school establishment. An illustration of this awesome reality comes out of the catastrophe of new math imposed on public schools during the 1960s and 70s. In the training sessions paid for by federal funds, school staff received explicit instructions to keep parents away. In schoolteacher training classes for the new math, prospective pedagogues were instructed to keep their hands off classroom instruction as much as possible. Student peer groups were to be considered by the teachers more important than parents in establishing motivation, more important than teachers too. Kids were to learn peer group control of the operation by trial and error. Nobody who understood the culture of kids in classrooms could have prescribed a more fatal medicine to law and order. But the experiment plunged recklessly ahead, this time on a national basis in the Vietnam-era United States. In the arithmetic of powerlessness that forced collectivism of this sort imposes, students, parents, and teachers are at the very bottom of the pecking order. But school administrators and local school boards are reduced by such politics to inconsequential mechanical functions, too. I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. These are the players in the school game. First category, government agency. State legislatures, particularly those politicians known in-house to specialize in educational matters. 2, ambitious politicians with high public visibility. 3, big city school boards controlling lucrative contracts. 4, the courts. 5, big city departments of education. 6, state departments of education. 7, federal department of education. 8, other government agencies, the National Science Foundation, National Training Laboratories, Defense Department, HUD, Labor Department, Health and Human Services, and many more. Second category, active special interests. 1, key private foundations. About a dozen of these curious entities have been the most important shapers of national education policy in this century, particularly those of Carnegie, Ford, and Rockefeller. 2. Giant corporations acting through a private association called the Business Roundtable, BR. Latest manifestation of a series of such associations dating back to the turn of the century. Some evidence of the centrality of business in the school mix was the composition of the New American Schools Development Corporation. It's made up of 18 members, which the uninitiated might assume would be drawn from a representative cross-section of parties interested in the shape of American schooling, was heavily weighted as follows. CEO RJR Nabisco, CEO Boeing, President Exxon, CEO AT&T, CEO Ashland Oil, CEO Martin Marietta, CEO Amex, CEO Eastman Kodak, CEO Warnaco, CEO Honeywell, CEO Ralston, CEO Arvin, Chairman B.F. Goodrich, also two ex-governors, two publishers, and a TV producer. 3. The United Nations through UNESCO, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, etc. 4, and this is the list of active special interests. Other private associations, the National Association of Manufacturers, Council on Economic Development, the Advertising Council, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Foreign Policy Association, etc. Professional unions, the National Education Association, American Federation of Teachers, Council of Supervisory Associations, etc. 6. Private educational interest groups, Council on Basic Education, Progressive Education Association, etc. Single interest groups, abortion activists pro and con, other advocates for special interests. Third category, the knowledge industry. 1. Colleges and universities. 2. Teacher training colleges. 3. Researchers. 4. Testing organizations. 5. Materials producers other than print. 6. Text publishers. 7. Knowledge brokers, subsystem designers. Control of the educational enterprise is distributed among at least these 22 players, each of which can be subdivided into in-house warring factions, which farther remove the decision-making process from simple accessibility. The financial interests of these associated voices are served whether children learn to read or not. There is little accountability. No matter how many assertions are made to the contrary, few penalties exist past a certain level on the organizational chart, unless a culprit runs afoul of the media. An explanation for the bitter truth whistleblowers regularly discover when they tell all, which explains why precious few experienced hands care to ruin themselves to act the hero. This is not to say sensitive, intelligent, moral, and concerned individuals aren't distributed through each of the 22 categories, but the conflict of interest is so glaring between serving a system loyally and serving the public that it is finally overwhelming. Indeed, it isn't hard to see that in strictly economic terms, this edifice of competing and conflicting interests is better served by badly performing schools than by successful ones. On economic grounds alone, a disincentive exists to improve schools. When schools are bad, demands for increased funding and personnel and professional control removed from public oversight can be pressed by simply pointing to the perilous state of the enterprise. But when things go well, getting an extra buck is like pulling teeth. Some of this political impasse grew naturally from a maze of competing interests. Some grew from more cynical calculations with exactly the end in mind we see. But whatever the formative motives, the net result is virtually impervious to democratically generated change. No large change can occur in system without a complicated coalition of separate interests backing it, not one of which can actually be a primary advocate for children and parents. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. By the end of 1999, 75.5 million people out of a total population of 275 million were involved directly in providing and receiving what has come to be called education, and an unknown number of millions indirectly. About 67 million were enrolled in schools and colleges. 4 million were employed as teachers or college faculty, and 4.5 million in some other school capacity. In other words, the primary organizing discipline of about 29% of the entire population consists of obedience to the routines and requests of an abstract social machine called school. And that's only so far. According to the U.S. Department of Education, these figures are expected to grow substantially through the first decade of the new century. Could Hegel himself have foreseen such an end to history? The planet as a universal schoolhouse where nothing much is learned? At the top of this feeding chain are the so-called public colleges. As Valhalla was the reward where Vikings killed in battle got to drink, fight, and fornicate in an endlessly regenerating loop, so public colleges are a lifetime of comfort and security for those systems people who play ball skillfully or belong to some political family with a record of playing ball. If public colleges functioned in meritocratic ways, as their supporters allege, and as I suspect the general public believes they do, we would expect the economy of public schooling at this level to reflect with reasonable sensitivity what was happening in the total public economy. Spending on public colleges should be a litmus test of how much respect is being accorded the democratic will at any given time. With that in mind, try this garment on for size. Tuition at public colleges over the last 14 years has increased 3 times as fast as household income and more than 3 times faster than the rate of inflation, according to the General Accounting Office. What pressure could possibly squeeze ordinary people to pay such outlandish costs, incurring debt burdens which enslave them and their children for many years to come? How, you might ask, at the very instant the inherent value of these degrees is being challenged, at the very instant business magazines are predicting permanent radical downsizing of the middle management force in private and public employment, the very slots public colleges license graduates to occupy, and at the very instant in time when the purchasing power of middle-class American incomes is worth less than it was 30 years ago and appears to be in a long-term continuing downtrend. How, in light of these things, have public college teachers been able to double their incomes in real dollars in the past 14 years, and public college administrators raise their own share of the take 131%? I'm asking how, not why. Greed is too common a characteristic of human nature to be very interesting. How was this done? Who allowed it? Not any, quote, free market, I can tell you. We're talking about several million individuals who've managed to make their leisured and secure lives even more so. At the same time, their product is questioned, and the work their attention supposedly qualifies students for is shipped overseas for labor cost advantages. It seems obvious to me that the whole lot of these collegiate time servers lack sufficient clout to treat themselves so well. Their favorite treatment is then a gift. But from where and why? Only from an investigation of the politics of schooling might come an adequate answer. So let's begin to look under a few rocks together. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. On June 24, 1996, in Franklin County, Ohio Common Pleas Court, the attorney for the American Federation of Teachers, speaking against Ohio's proposed parent choice initiative, called parents, quote, inconsequential conduits. The Columbus Dispatch quoted Denny Widner, parent of three, as saying, "I can't believe we have to fight for an education. I'm a flunky, and that's what they're trying to make my kid," close quote. Although his income was well below the poverty line, Mr. Widner was armed with comparative school information that convinced him his own children were being deliberately dumbed down. In public kindergarten, his youngest daughter had only learned the alphabet. But he was fully aware that, at private school, they were reading in kindergarten. Though it was 20 years and more ago, I remember well that day in 1979 when I loaded my old Ford station wagon with broken tape recorders, broken movie projectors, broken record players, broken tripods, broken typewriters, broken editing machines, etc., some nearly new and still under warranty, and without notifying anyone, trucked it all over to the repair facility on Court Street in Brooklyn, because the Bureau of Audiovisual Instruction had failed to respond to three official requests for help from the school. This was an errand of mercy for a new principal, a fine North Carolina lady serving her probationary period, a woman for whom I had a high regard because she broke rules to do the things that mattered. The executive on duty at BAVI had once been a coordinator at the school I was coming from. Apart from his job title, he was a likable sort who reminded me of Arnold Stang in the old Captain Video show. But when he saw my load of wreckage, he exploded. "What are you trying to pull?" he said. "We don't have time to repair these things." Official letters of referral did, in fact, assign the repair function to BAVI. If not them, then who? Because I was there, the equipment was accepted. But shortly afterwards, I heard on the grapevine that it had been thrown out, and my principal upbraided for her lack of decorum in trying to have it repaired. Broken machinery is a signal to buy new, and may be reckoned among the lifeblood factors of schools' partnership with the larger economy. As long as I'm reminiscing, I remember also an earlier time when a different principal wanted to, quote, make space in the audiovisual vault. Some years earlier, a one-time foundation windfall had been expended on 39 overhead projectors, even though the school already had 10, and nobody but administrators and gym teachers used them anyway because they bored the life out of kids. "Could you help me out, John, and pitch those things somewhere after school when nobody is around to see? I'll owe you one." The reason I was asked, I think, besides the fact that I always drove an old station wagon and had no reluctance about using it for school matters, was that I always insisted on talking as an equal to school people, whatever their title or status. I saw them as colleagues engaged in the same joint enterprise I was enrolled in myself. This disrespect for the chain of command sometimes bred a kind of easy familiarity with administrators, denied more conventional teachers with an us-and-them outlook. In any case, I drove some of the junk to the dumpster at the entrance to the trail to Lake Rutherford in High Point State Park in New Jersey, the rest to a dump near my farm in Norwich, New York, where 10,000 or so in equipment was duly buried by the bulldozer. Incidentally, I recall being expressly forgiven to give these projectors away because they might be traced back to Community School District 3. Community School District 3 Manhattan is the source of most of my school memories, the spot where I spent much of my adult working life. I remember a summer program there in 1971 where the administrator in charge ran frantically from room to room the last week of the term, asking that teachers help him out by spending some large amount of money, $30,000 is the figure that comes to mind, that he had squirreled away on the books. When we protested the school term was over, he explained he was fearful of being evaluated poorly on money management and that might cost him a chance to become a principal. Getting rid of money at the end of the term so it didn't have to be returned was a major recurring theme during my years in District 3. Another District 3 story I'll not soon forget is the time the school board approved funds for the purchase of 5,000 Harbrace College handbooks at $11 each after it had been brought to their attention by my wife that the identical book was being remaindered in job lots at Barnes & Noble's main store on 17th Street for $1 a copy. Not on the list of approved vendors, I might have been told, though it's too long ago to recall. Why do these things happen? Any reasonable person might ask that question. And the answer is at one and the same easy and not easy to give. When we talk about politics and schooling, we draw together as one what in reality are two quite different matters. It will clarify the discussion to divide school politics into a macro and a micro component. The macro politics dictate that holes in floors cannot be fixed or machinery repaired or independent tech secured at the fair market rate. The macro politics of schooling are deadly serious. They deal with policy issues unknown to the public, largely out of reach of elected representatives, senators and presidents included, and are almost impervious to public outrage and public morality. Hence the windfall for teachers and administrators at public colleges over the past decade and a half. On the other hand, the micropolitics of schooling deal with the customary venality of little fish in their dealings with even littler fish. I speak of the invisible market in petty favors that school administrators run in virtually every public school in the land, a market that trades in after-school jobs, partial teaching programs, desirable rooms, desirable classes, schedules that enable certain teachers but not others to beat the Friday rush hour traffic to Long Island, all the contemptible non-cash currency without which the management of schooling would become very difficult. The micropolitics of schooling are degrading, disgusting, and demoralizing, but it pales in importance before macro-political decisions about time, sequencing, curriculum, personnel, ties of schooling to the economy, and matters of that magnitude, for which the opinions of school people are never significant. What follows in this chapter is mostly a consideration of the macro world. But if I had to sum up in one image how otherwise decent people conspire through schooling against hard-working ordinary people to waste their money, I would tell my auditors of the time I tried energetically to save a social studies chairman a substantial amount of money in purchasing supplies, even though I wasn't in his department. I happened to know where he could buy what he wanted at about 50% less than he was preparing to pay. After tolerating my presentation and dismissing it, he became irritated when I pressed the case. What are you getting agitated for, John? It's not your money. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, the result of 10 years of research into the origin and functions of compulsory schooling in America. Gatto spent 30 years as a teacher in New York City schools and decided to quit abruptly in 1991 after having been named New York State Teacher of the Year, announcing on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal that he could no longer continue hurting children. You can download this entire book online for free and find out more about his work at johntaylorgatto.com. Gatto is GATTO.com. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And thanks to Dana Lyons and David Rovics for the use of their music in this week's program. And to you for listening. They'll take